Cutting-edge science is too advanced for anyone to have a reasonable chance of making a significant contribution unless they first have sufficient education in science. The pace of change in any active field of research is so rapid that a researcher must keep in contact with the community of scientists through journals, meetings, and seminars just to keep up. This modern status of the practice of science is a double-edged sword. It's a testimony to the success of institutionalized scientific research and the progress that has been made so far. However, it also tends to alienate the amateur scientist and the public. The lay or amateur scientist must be content to sit on the sidelines and learn about exciting scientific discoveries in those books, journals, and lectures that are designed to distill this information for the public. No matter how great the interest, the private citizen can't just fire up a particle accelerator in their backyard and make important discoveries in particle physics. Professional scientists understand that even for them, it's difficult to contribute meaningfully to a field even marginally outside their area of expertise. There are, however, citizen scientist projects in which interested people can participate. You can classify galaxies, find Kuiper belt objects, and fold proteins. Trained scientists are responsible for maintaining a rigorous procedure, however. Some amateur scientists aren't content to sit on the sidelines or be citizen scientists. They weave hypotheses and sometimes even carry out experiments in highly specialized fields. Often, their conclusions are somewhat naive and betray their lack of formal training. Perhaps keenly aware of this potential shortcoming, the pseudoscientist is quick to turn a lack of training into a putative virtue by arguing that this is actually an advantage. The argument frequently put forward is that formally trained scientists are brainwashed into a narrow view of reality. They are, in effect, pawns of the status quo, unable to think outside the box. The untrained scientist, by contrast, is free to conceive of unique and truly innovative ideas. The truth becomes obvious to them, while trained scientists can't see the forest for the trees. On my blog, Neurologica, I had a detailed debate with comic book artist Neil Adams. Adams believes that the Earth is hollow and growing, gaining matter over time. The full debate is amazing to behold, and the excerpted tidbits below are phenomenal interactions and classic examples of pseudoscience. First, Adams is unfazed by the fact that his wild speculations aren't generally accepted by scientists. He wrote, "Of course I'm going to be dismissed by most educated scientists. For me, I'm not quite as impressed by formal education. I can read, and there are no books forbidden to me in the end. I can think, and I use many aspects of science in my work." The flaw in this argument is that knowledge isn't necessarily constricting. It can also be liberating. The more one knows, the easier it is to learn more information. Knowledge provides intellectual tools that can be applied to the process of discovery. Also, knowledge of what is already known helps in evaluating the plausibility of new ideas. I admit it's easy to understand how this view can be interpreted as elitist, and pseudoscientists often take great rhetorical advantage of this fact. Keep in mind, however, that I'm not making the argument from authority that scientists who hold advanced degrees are always right simply because of their training. I'm not even saying that someone without a degree can't be correct in a scientific claim. Their claims should be judged solely on the basis of their logic and evidence. What I'm saying is that ignorance isn't an advantage, nor is it a virtue to be touted. It's a hindrance. 4. Reliance upon weak forms of evidence while dismissing more rigorous evidence. There is no way to remove the need for judgment from the process of science. You can't apply a mathematical formula to a claim to determine if it's valid, although people try. You have to weigh evidence, decide which kind of evidence is most significant, and determine which explanations are most likely. It is with these kinds of judgments that scientists need to be most careful, and pseudoscientists run into deep trouble. They can be so biased that they will casually dismiss conclusions based upon mountains of rigorous evidence, while citing the flimsiest of evidence to support their alternative claims. In order to read and appreciate the technical literature, scientists must know how to evaluate the quality of an experiment, look for flaws in the design, and determine if the study has the power and sensitivity to detect what the experimenters are trying to detect. Reading original scientific research is highly technical and requires detailed knowledge of methods and statistics. This skill is critical as many, if not most, published studies are in fact wrong in their conclusions. Most studies are preliminary and not very rigorous. Pseudoscientists, by contrast, will tend to accept any testimony or anecdote that supports their desired belief. They will sometimes present large volumes of low-quality evidence, implying that a large amount of poor-quality evidence equates to high-quality evidence. Alternative medicine guru Andrew Weil, for example, supports the use of uncontrolled clinical observations in determining whether or not a treatment works. Such observations have a history, however, of being contradicted by later, well-controlled and more reliable experiments. This is a lesson that good scientists have learned and that pseudoscientists deride. A classic example of this can be seen in the field of UFO research. Believers often tout the great number of UFO sightings as compelling evidence that were being visited by aliens. Skeptical scientists, however, are more compelled by the fact that there is not one single piece of high-quality evidence to support the alien hypothesis. 5. Cherry-picking data. Closely related to the use of poor data is the selective use of data. Scientific experiments are designed to take a complete look at a sequential set of data. Anecdotal evidence is by definition selective because it is limited to self-reporting and is not a thorough analysis of all outcomes. Patients who die receiving a specific treatment, for example, aren't around to give anecdotes about their experience with the treatment. This is called the survivor bias. There are many ways to cherry-pick data. Early ESP research is infamous for finding ways to select the data the researchers want. They introduced the idea of optional starting and stopping because, they claimed, psychic individuals need time to warm up before their powers work, and their powers will then work only until they become too fatigued. Then they will stop working again. Therefore, researchers could look at a sequence of data, like guessing what cards a target was looking at, and decide when to start and stop counting the data. They could easily mine the data for sequences that were statistically significant. They were simply cherry-picking the data they wanted and discarding the rest. There's a more conventional term for this procedure. It's called cheating. 6. Fundamental principles are often based upon a single case. This is really just an extension of the over-reliance upon testimony and anecdote as a feature of pseudoscience. Some entire belief systems that pretend to be scientific base their fundamental underlying principles on a single uncontrolled observation. Any good scientist, before launching into a research career investigating some principle, will first make sure that the principle in question is correct, lest he risk wasting an entire career on a false idea. Certainly, before applying a basic principle to the real world, by, for example, using it to treat patients, it should be verified with repeatable experiments. Some pseudosciences, however, have extrapolated an entire elaborate belief system around a single observation that was never verified. My favorite two examples are chiropractic and iridology. D.D. Palmer, the originator of chiropractic, reported that he, quote, discovered the primary underlying principle of chiropractic when he cured a janitor of his deafness by manipulating his neck, thereby relieving, he believed, the pressure on the auditory nerve. Palmer conducted no experiments of any kind to verify his assumptions, but rather extrapolated all of classic chiropractic theory and practice from this single case. D.D. Palmer was apparently unaware of the fact that the auditory nerve, and in fact the entire neurological pathway responsible for hearing, at no point passes through the neck. Iridology has a similar history and is based upon the observation of a single owl. Apparently, Ignaz von Pessely, a Hungarian physician, noticed that an owl that had injured its wing had a particular fleck of color in the iris of its eye. He set the owl's wing, which later healed well. Dr. Pessely then noticed that the fleck of color in the owl's iris had disappeared. From this single observation, Dr. Pessely developed a system of diagnosing all human disease by the pattern of colors in the iris. In truth, the story of the owl may be apocryphal, and Dr. Pesley made up iridology out of whole cloth. 7. Failure to engage with the scientific community. Science is hard and getting harder. We've picked most of the low-hanging fruit, answered all the big and easy questions, and we are now engaged in complex research to address more and more sophisticated and subtle scientific questions. For this reason, it's difficult for any one person alone to make significant advances in our understanding. It's generally too challenging to address all possible flaws and errors, consider all possible alternatives, and look at a problem from multiple perspectives by oneself. The scientific community has a better chance of doing this as a whole. That's why scientists publish their data in peer-reviewed journals and discuss their ideas at meetings. They're testing their ideas, addressing criticisms, and accounting for new ideas. Pseudoscientists tend to be disconnected from this process, or perhaps exist in a protected echo chamber of similar believing pseudoscientists. They ferment their ideas by themselves, which often allows them to drift further and further from reality. 8. Claims often promise easy and simplistic solutions to complex problems or questions. One of the primary reasons for the psychological appeal of pseudoscience is that it provides a putative easy answer to a complex problem. Classic chiropractic, for example, states that all human disease is caused by spinal subluxations, and therefore spinal manipulation can be used to cure all human disease. Nutrition guru Gary Null, by contrast, claims that all human disease is caused by nutritional deficiencies, and therefore all disease can be prevented or cured by taking nutritional supplements. In a broader sense, this feature relates to the psychology of belief. Pseudosciences all tend to have a particular psychological appeal, of which providing easy answers is just one example. Others include alleged evidence of a supernatural or spiritual world, confirmation of deeply held religious beliefs, illusion of personal empowerment or control, or simply the appeal of the fantastical or unusual. 9. Utilizing scientific-sounding but ultimately meaningless language. All sciences have their technical jargon. The purpose of jargon is simply to express complex technical concepts in precise terminology. Subtle distinctions can often be very important, and colloquial language may not have the precision necessary to unambiguously convey the necessary meaning. Moreover, as new concepts and entities are discovered, new words must be invented to refer to them. There's also a tendency to render the resulting cumbersome terminology into a more convenient shorthand, which can add an additional barrier to understanding for the public. The most challenging aspect of popularizing science is often translating technical jargon into everyday language while minimizing the loss of precision and accuracy. For example, as a neurologist, I may describe a patient as having cerebellar ataxia instead of just saying they are clumsy. This is because clumsiness is a general phenomenon that may have many causes, while cerebellar ataxia is a specific neurological phenomenon that correlates with specific structures in the nervous system. Pseudosciences often imitate real science by cloaking themselves in pseudo-jargon. The result is the frequent use of scientific-sounding terminology that lacks a precise definition, much like the technobabble in a typical episode of Star Trek. For example, Gwyneth Paltrow's lifestyle brand Goop sells Body Vibes stickers they claim will promote healing. The concept: human bodies operate at an ideal energetic frequency, but everyday stresses and anxiety can throw off our internal balance, depleting our energy reserves and weakening our immune systems. Body Vibes stickers come pre-programmed to an ideal frequency, allowing them to target imbalances. While you're wearing them, close to your heart on your left shoulder or arm, they'll fill in the deficiencies in your reserves, creating a calming effect, smoothing out both physical tension and anxiety. The founders, both estheticians, also say they help clear skin by reducing inflammation and boosting cell turnover. Translation: magic stickers. 10. Lack of humility, making bold claims on flimsy evidence. Successful science must intelligently combine almost giddy speculation with harsh conservatism. Scientists must invent hypotheses which extend the limits of human knowledge, introduce entirely new concepts, or invent new aspects of nature. At the same time, they must not accept any conclusion unless it's rigorously supported by solid evidence and all other reasonable alternatives have been eliminated. In this way, science attempts not only to move forward, but also to build on a solid foundation. For this reason, technical literature tends to utilize very conservative language and is careful not to endorse or promote any conclusions that cannot be rigorously supported. Those scientists who make premature claims are typically harshly criticized by their colleagues for doing so. The premature announcement to the press of the achievement of cold fusion by physicists Stanley Pons and Martin Fleischmann, for example, did great damage to their professional careers. Part of this is also being humble. If you find a result that contradicts well-established scientific conclusions, your first thought should be that you made a mistake, not that you just overturned an entire field of science. Pseudoscientists, by contrast, make use of bold claims, superlative descriptions, and unrestrained, self-serving accolades. Their discoveries are often touted, for example, as being world-altering in their scope and their implications for humanity. Getting back to our friend Neil Adams, he wrote, "Imagine being me, seeing these unexplained ridge complexes everywhere and being the almost only person on Earth who knows what they are, pull-aparts, the only thing they can be." He thinks he has a unique insight that allows him to look at geological formations and the map of the Earth and see the truth. When it's pointed out to him that his ideas conflict with entire areas of science, he simply overturns them. The Earth grows by gaining matter, so gravity doesn't work like scientists thought, and neither does particle physics. He also wrote, "Know how fast the moon goes over the face of the Earth? 1,000 miles per hour. I think the water compresses. Got some textbooks want to be rewritten?" And, "There is no standard model. It is, in fact, all a little math game of where the densities are, and it's all theorizing. This is a very big topic, and without exposing you to several papers and long involved discussion, let me simply say, at the end of the day, densities evolve to when and where iron is." The standard model of particle physics is in my way? Gone. 11. Claiming to be years or decades ahead of the curve. One dramatic red flag that someone is making claims that go way beyond the evidence is that the breakthroughs they are claiming would require years or even decades of supportive research, and yet there is little or no scientific paper trail to support them. For example, starting in 2013 when writing his book, Immortal, Why Consciousness is Not in the Brain, and through 2017, Italian surgeon Sergio Canavero claimed he was close to performing the world's first head transplant. We can argue about whether or not this would be called a body transplant. In an interview with Newsweek, he said, "I can only disclose that there has been massive progress in medical experiments, which would have seemed impossible even as recently as a few months ago. The milestones we have reached will undoubtedly revolutionize medicine." This is a bold claim. In order for such an operation to be considered successful, Canavero must have found a way to regenerate the spinal cord. Otherwise, the head would be attached to a completely paralyzed body. Canavero is claiming not just that he has perfected the surgical technique of removing a head from one body and attaching it to another, but that he has solved the problem of spinal cord regeneration. This is more than impressive, given that labs around the world have been working on this problem for decades, with only incremental advances, nothing really clinically useful. Even more impressive is that Canavero and his colleagues apparently did this in secret, without publishing a single paper or earning a single grant to conduct the needed research. They did all the basic science, animal studies, and clinical trials without leaving a single word of evidence in the scientific literature. The fact is, modern science is complex and requires significant infrastructure and collaboration. Before we figure out how to actually regenerate spinal cords, scientists will need to put 100 pieces of that puzzle together. They will be hundreds, maybe even thousands of published studies leading up to the clinical trials that eventually show success. It's simply not feasible to have leapfrogged all this necessary science, making decades of progress in a few years, all from nothing. 12. Attempts to shift the burden of proof away from themselves. It is generally accepted within the scientific community that anyone making a claim to any truth bears the burden of proving their claim. The more out of sync such a claim is with accepted reality, the greater this burden of proof becomes. Pseudoscientists, often because they cannot prove their claims, frequently attempt to shift the burden of proof to those who are skeptical of those claims. They maintain that their claim must be accepted as true because it hasn't been proven false. This shift in the burden of proof often takes the form of our logical fallacy friend known as the argument from ignorance, the one that says that if we don't yet know the cause of a phenomenon, it must be paranormal. For example, ghost hunters will often present photographs containing blobs or wisps of light and claim that because these photographic artifacts can't be precisely explained, they must be ghosts. Neil Adams again, after I asked him for a bit of evidence to support his hollow growing earth claims. Are you suggesting that I provide a new invention or show you a discovery of some magic thing that no one else has ever made before, like a flying mechanical donkey? I don't have one. I have all the same things that are known by many people, like Darwin. Darwin didn't have to go to the Galapagos to observe what he did. He simply went there. The evidence was and is everywhere. It was his eyes and his brain that drew the conclusions. The question is, will you take the chip off your shoulder long enough to see what I see and think with me? 13. Rendering claims non-falsifiable. Sometimes the pseudoscientists not only shift the burden of proof away from themselves, they also attempt to make their claims immune to refutation. Often this is done through inventing reasons why the expected evidence doesn't exist or experiments are negative. For example, homeopaths sometimes say that their products can't be tested against placebos because they only work as part of an entire treatment program. This makes it impossible to isolate homeopathy as a specific variable. Of course, when you do isolate homeopathic products, they don't work. At times, the claim is formulated in such a way that it cannot be falsified even in theory. Creationists, for example, are fond of saying that we cannot know the mind of God. Therefore, we cannot say why nature looks the way it does. God just happened to make a creature that looks halfway between a dinosaur and a bird for his own unimaginable reasons. Ironically, doing so doesn't rescue the claim from being pseudoscientific, but makes it more so. A scientific hypothesis must be falsifiable. If it isn't, then it's not even wrong. Being wrong in science is useful. It still helps us move toward the answer. Being not even wrong is worthless and is by definition not scientific. 14. Violating Occam's razor and failing to fairly consider all competing hypotheses. One critical step in the process of scientific discovery is to consider all possible explanations for any observation or phenomenon. Often, a scientific hypothesis is considered to be probably true because it's the best and simplest current fit for all available data. If all reasonable alternatives haven't been considered, however, this conclusion is likely premature. Pseudoscientists, because they are invested in a desired conclusion, will give only perfunctory consideration to competing hypotheses. Often one or two token alternatives will be put forward and summarily shot down, leaving the desired belief as the only possibility. Ufologists are most notorious for this behavior. The classic unidentified light in the sky cannot be a plane or a star, therefore it must be an alien spacecraft. As part of this, pseudoscientists routinely violate Occam's razor by dismissing simpler explanations for more complex or implausible ones that fit their beliefs. Remember Arnold and spontaneous human combustion? He casually dismissed simpler explanations for alleged cases, even when there were obvious external sources of flame. Perhaps the most dramatic example is a 1980 case from Chorley, England. The charred remains of an elderly woman were found in her apartment. Here's the kicker. Her head was in the fireplace. She'd clearly fallen and hit her head on the grate. The corollary to this shortcoming is the failure to reject a disproved but desired hypothesis. This is often the ultimate test of a scientist's objectivity. Can they discard a cherished hypothesis when it's confronted with incontrovertible, disconfirming evidence? For the pseudoscientist, no amount of disconfirming evidence will result in such rejection. 15. Failure to challenge core assumptions. What often passes for research within pseudosciences addresses questions about the alleged phenomenon but isn't designed to test whether or not the phenomenon exists. This is what fellow science-based medicine writer Harriet Hall called tooth fairy science. Imagine you perform a, quote, scientific study in which you carefully collect data on the amount of money the tooth fairy leaves behind and run sophisticated statistical analyses correlating the amount given with the type and size of the tooth and the age and gender of the child. This type of study would have all the trappings of serious science, but would never address the key underlying questions. Is the tooth fairy real? And who is actually leaving the money? We often find these types of studies within alternative medicine. How is a particular alternative treatment being used? By whom? And what are their attitudes toward it? Such studies don't address the questions of whether or not the treatment works and the underlying philosophy is valid. Once efficacy studies start to come back negative, we find that proponents stop doing them in favor of more tooth fairy type studies. In a famous speech at Caltech in 1974, Richard Feynman referred to such practices as cargo cult science. He made an analogy to the pre-industrial Melanesian tribes who, after World War II, would build grass huts and fake runways hoping to attract the supply planes that delivered goods during the war. Their rituals had only a superficial resemblance to actual landing strips and lacked the necessary technology and infrastructure. Similarly, pseudoscience may superficially resemble the ritual of doing research, but it lacks the true essence of real science, rigorously testing hypotheses with evidence capable of proving them wrong. In short, pseudoscientists engage in motivated reasoning. See Chapter 9. They'll commit endless special pleading to explain away experimental failures, like the presence of skeptics causing psychic ability to stop working. By keeping in mind the characteristics just outlined, one can make a reasonable judgment about a claim or theory and determine where along the spectrum it lies from solid science to absurd pseudoscience. Evolutionary science, for example, pulls together multiple independent lines of evidence, has been debated transparently for decades, and has stood the test of multiple observations that could have potentially disproved it. It remains the only viable scientific explanation for the life we see in the world. At the other end of the spectrum is poor Neil Adams. He desperately wants to be taken seriously as a scientist, but he has done none of the actual work. He has nothing except wacky ideas based on his own superficial observations, and he blithely suggests a cascading transformation of virtually all of modern science to accommodate his wild notions. Somewhere in the middle is Daryl Bem and his ESP research. He is following standard scientific protocol to an extent, but is overwhelmed by his own biases. In the end, he's created a great example of pseudoscience, with all the trappings of science, but failing to rigorously prove his main hypothesis. Chapter 23, Skeptic's Guide Entry, Denialism. Denialism, or science denial, refers to the motivated denial of accepted science using a series of invalid strategies. I deny nothing, but doubt everything. Lord Byron. Denialism is a real thing, by which I mean that denialism is a definable intellectual strategy with consistent features that tend to cluster together. Denialism begins with the desire to deny an accepted scientific or historical fact, and therefore, like all pseudosciences, works backward from the desired conclusion. In fact, denialism is a subset of pseudoscience, one that tries to cloak itself in the language of skepticism while eschewing the actual process of scientific skepticism. Denialism exists on a spectrum with skepticism without a clear demarcation between the two, similar to science and pseudoscience. People tend to use themselves for calibration. Anyone more skeptical than you is a denier, and anyone less skeptical than you is a true believer. At this point, science denial has become common in our society and may be more impactful than the promotion of pseudoscientific beliefs that are not true. There are ideological movements that deny the scientific consensus of anthropogenic global climate change, the modern synthesis of evolutionary theory, the germ theory of disease, that the brain causes consciousness, the existence of mental illness, that HIV causes AIDS, and the safety and effectiveness of vaccines. There are even those who deny the existence of denialism itself, arguing that this is just a rhetorical device to shut down criticism of mainstream ideas. They miss the fact that denialism relies upon a set of invalid logical strategies. It's defined by these features, not the belief itself. As you will see, many of the strategies used by deniers are insidious because they are extreme versions of reasonable positions. Some of their underlying principles are sound. It's their specific application that's the problem. What follows is a list of some of the most prevalent denialist strategies. Manufacture and exaggerate doubt. Doubt is key to skepticism and science. The absence of doubt is gullibility. This feature, most of all, is what makes denialism pseudo-skepticism. The problem with the denialist approach is that doubt is not used as a tool of honest questioning, but rather for undermining a belief one doesn't like. This strategy can also be called just asking questions or jacking off. You can often tell the difference between science and denialism because when true scientists ask a question, they want an answer and will give due consideration to any possibilities. Deniers, on the other hand, will ask the same undermining questions over and over, long after they have been definitively answered. The questions used to cast doubt are all they are interested in, not the process of discovery they're meant to inspire. Of course, there is always doubt in science. Science is never 100% certain about anything, because science is not about certainty. It's not even really about proving things, but rather disproving them. Science is also not directly about truth, but rather about building testable models that predict how the universe behaves. Scientific theories become progressively more accepted as they survive serious attempts at proving them wrong. Such acceptance is provisional, however, as the next experiment or observation could potentially falsify any theory. Theories are favored when they have useful explanatory power and are consistent with other accepted theories as we slowly build one coherent model about how the universe works. Scientific literacy means not only understanding what the best current scientific explanation of a phenomenon is, but also how sure we are that the current answer is correct, and how complete an answer it is. What does it leave unexplained? Some theories are controversial, others simply unknown, while still others are fairly robust. At the extreme end of the spectrum are those theories that are, as Stephen Jay Gould noted, confirmed to such a degree that it would be perverse to withhold provisional assent. Deniers exaggerate our current level of doubt about a scientific theory and minimize what is known. They perversely withhold even their provisional assent. Often they take this strategy to the extreme of denying that we could know anything. They deny scientific knowledge itself. As part of the strategy, they will likely appeal to the fact that scientific knowledge has changed over time. If scientists were wrong in the past, they can be wrong now. Of course, no one denies that current scientific knowledge is provisional. That misses the point entirely. They are essentially making a false analogy between a prior belief that wasn't well established and one that is currently very robust, even rock solid. Always ask for more evidence than exists or can exist. Perhaps the core logical fallacy of the denier is moving the goalposts, a technique described in Chapter 10. They ask for evidence, and when that evidence is provided, they demand still more evidence. Nothing will ever satisfy them. This is very different from how science normally operates. After preliminary research clarifies the questions being asked and how the evidence relates to current theories, scientists supporting competing theories will often put their nickel down. They'll state exactly what evidence will refute their theory, refute competing theories, or will change their mind about which theory is superior. When the evidence comes in, scientists will actually change their mind. Of course, individuals don't always change their mind with the evidence, but enough do to shift the consensus to the theory supported by the evidence. Deniers rarely do this. When their questions are answered or their demands for evidence met, they simply slide over to another question. Nothing will convince them because they've already decided on the answer. For example, evolution deniers are fond of pointing out gaps in the fossil record, or our knowledge of which species evolved from which ancestors. They take a snapshot of our current scientific knowledge and argue that the existence of gaps in that knowledge calls into question the more fundamental conclusions about what is happening. Because we cannot prove, for example, what group birds evolved from, evolution itself is questioned. The previously mentioned God of the Gaps strategy. Scientific theories, however, are better judged by how useful they are than what they can currently explain. What evolution deniers should be asking is not what evolution can explain right now, but how has it fared over the years? Specifically, if evolutionary theory is useful and correct, those gaps should be shrinking over time. How they change over time is more telling than how big they are at any one moment in time. Anyone even casually familiar with evolutionary biology knows the answer to this question. Those gaps have been steadily decreasing. The gaps between humans and our closest ape relative, birds and dinosaurs, whales and terrestrial animals, fish and tetrapods, and many others have been filled in nicely in the last century. Evolution deniers pointed to all these gaps in the past, and when they were filled in, they never acknowledged that fact. They just focused on another gap. One of their favorite gaps now is the one between bats and other mammals. When that one gets filled, they'll move on to something else. All this goalpost moving can be tiring, however, so some deniers use a simpler strategy. They simply ask for more evidence than can possibly exist. Sticking with evolution as an example, they will ask for one fossil that proves evolution. This, of course, is impossible, because evolution is a complex process. There are similar calls from HIV deniers to point to one paper that proves the human immunodeficiency virus is the sole cause of the acquired immune deficiency syndrome. These claims require dozens, even hundreds, of individual studies added together. Anti-vaccinationists who deny the safety and effectiveness of vaccines commonly ask for a randomized vaccinated versus unvaccinated study. While this may seem reasonable at first, they know such a study will never be done. They are essentially requiring a study that randomizes children to receive no vaccines at all. It's unethical. Vaccines are already part of the standard of care because they have proven benefits. In the clinical trial, you cannot randomize subjects to not receive standard treatment. They set the bar this high so they can deny the value of all other evidence that shows vaccines are safe. There are vaccinated versus unvaccinated studies, just not randomized, and there are many other types of studies showing the safety of vaccines. This strategy also uses special pleading. If a study shows that there is no association between the timing of vaccines and the incidence of autism or any other outcome, they'll say that the effect is delayed, or is from the vaccines the mother received while pregnant. If there's no dose response, that's because maximal negative effects are reached at tiny doses. If an ingredient is removed, then trace amounts are sufficient to have the negative effect, or some other ingredient is to blame. No evidence will ever be enough. Use semantics to deny categories of evidence. As part of the strategy to deny evidence for the scientific theory they wish to dismiss, deniers will often play word games to exclude entire categories of evidence. For example, evolution deniers have argued that anything that happened in the past is beyond the reach of science. Science is about experiments. You cannot run an experiment on evolution, therefore evolution is not even science. This is an artificially narrow definition of science, however. Science is about using empirical evidence to test hypotheses. The past leaves traces of itself behind, evidence. We can ask falsifiable questions about what happened in the past, including evolution. Obviously, fossils are left behind, but so are the genes and other features of living things. Those who deny the existence of mental illness play similar semantic games. They narrowly define illness as pathological disease, meaning that there has to be something objectively abnormal about cells, tissues, or organs. This description does apply to some diseases, but not all. There are disorders that are defined by the way some organ or system is functioning, but in the absence of clear pathology. Migraine headaches, for example, are a clear disorder without any diagnosable pathology. There are many brain disorders, because brain function depends upon more than just the health of brain cells. Healthy brain cells may still be organized and networked in such a way that their function is disordered. The brain is the organ of mood, thoughts, and behavior. Disordered brain function may therefore lead to a mood disorder or thought disorder. We call such entities mental illness. Mental illness deniers, such as Scientologists who are against the psychiatric profession, don't speak meaningfully about the relationship between brain function and symptoms of mental disorders, but rather use semantics to deny that such things even exist. Interpret disagreements about details as if they call the deeper consensus into question. To understand this feature of denialism, you have to first understand something about science itself. As science progresses, it tends to dig deeper into finer and finer details about how nature works, and hopefully achieves a more fundamental understanding. It's important to think of scientific knowledge as acting on different levels, with some levels being deeper than others. For example, it was known since antiquity that certain traits can be passed down from parents to children. It's obvious that children look like their parents. It was thought, however, that the biological mechanism for inheritance was a pattern, a little homunculus curled up inside each sperm that was the template for the child. Mendel and others discovered that some traits seem to be inherited discretely. When you cross a yellow pea with a green pea, you get some pattern of yellow and green peas, not mixed yellow-green peas. This trait didn't blend. Not all traits work that way, but it showed that some are transferred as discrete units, or genes. At that point, we hadn't identified the molecule that carried this information. Some scientists thought it would be proteins, but it was eventually demonstrated convincingly that the molecule of inheritance is DNA. That DNA carries genes and heritable information is now so well established that it could be considered a scientific fact. Yet there remained a great deal we didn't know about DNA and genes. We later discovered the genetic code, how that code is translated into proteins, and how DNA function is regulated. We still have many more details to learn about DNA. But, and here is the critical part, nothing we currently don't know about DNA, or will learn in the future, can possibly change the basic fact that DNA is the primary molecule of inheritance. Scientists, arguing about the details of gene regulation, or stating how much we don't know about the evolution of the genetic code, doesn't call into question this fundamental fact. That, however, is exactly what many denialists argue. That is, in fact, the favorite strategy of neuroscience denialism, specifically the denial that consciousness is essentially the functioning of the brain. Dualists, or those who think that the brain doesn't explain consciousness, point to what we currently don't know about how the brain produces consciousness, which shouldn't reduce our confidence in the conclusion that the brain does indeed cause consciousness. The same is true for evolution. That life is the result of common descent through an evolutionary process has been demonstrated beyond any reasonable scientific doubt. There is no competing theory that can come even close to accounting for the evidence we have, or that has been as successful in predicting what we will find when we explore biology. Evolution is a slam dunk. But, of course, there is always complexity and argument in the details. What exactly evolved from what? What is the pace and tempo of evolution? Have we accounted for all the forces at work? These are all interesting questions, but none of them call into question the fact that evolution occurred. Deny and distort the consensus. Magnifying disagreements among scientists is easy, because such disagreements are always present. This strategy can take two basic forms. The first is to magnify the implication of the disagreement, as I just described. The second is to present a small minority dissent as if it's a mainstream controversy. You can almost always find some scientists somewhere to disagree with even the most solid scientific consensus. I've argued that this is a good thing. Complacency can lead to stagnation in science, and it's always good to have someone shaking the tree. But such dissent needs to be put into context. Sometimes it's a genuine controversy, and the science can go either way. Other times the science is solid, and the dissent is insignificant. Recent political controversies over anthropogenic global warming, AGW, have brought the consensus argument to center stage. Defenders of AGW argue that there is a strong scientific consensus that the globe is warming due to human activity. A 2013 survey of the published scientific literature, for example, described its method and findings as follows. We analyzed the evolution of the scientific consensus on anthropogenic global warming, AGW, in the peer-reviewed scientific literature examining 11,944 climate abstracts from 1991 to 2011, matching the topics global climate change or global warming. We find that 66.4% of abstracts expressed no position on AGW, 32.6% endorsed AGW, 0.7% rejected AGW, and 0.3% were uncertain about the cause of global warming. Among abstracts expressing a position on AGW, 97.1% endorsed the consensus position that humans are causing global warming. This was the source for the famous 97% consensus figure that is widely quoted, although it doesn't refer to 97% of climate scientists, but rather 97% of published studies that either explicitly or implicitly expressed an opinion about AGW. This is in line with other research on the question. Another way to establish a scientific consensus is for scientific organizations to review the evidence and then make a determination. The 2013 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report, for example, concluded with 95% confidence that AGW is real. There is also a very strong consensus that currently available genetically modified organisms are safe for human consumption. More than 20 international scientific organizations have reviewed the research and independently come to this conclusion. For example, in 2013, the American Association for the Advancement of Science concluded that the science is quite clear. Crop improvement by the modern molecular techniques of biotechnology is safe. Turning to evolution, 98% of the world's scientists in biological fields agree with the consensus that life is the result of organic evolution. Deniers will not only deny that a consensus exists, they'll often deny that a scientific consensus is meaningful. They try to portray referring to a robust scientific consensus as an argument from authority logical fallacy. This, of course, is not the case. That fallacy is the result of inappropriately relying upon an individual as if they were a sufficient authority, or relying upon the opinion of those without appropriate expertise, such as celebrities. It can also be a fallacy if it's used to deflect valid criticism or evidence. For a non-expert to cite a legitimate consensus of experts, however, isn't a fallacy. In fact, substituting your own non-expert opinion in place of a robust consensus of recognized experts is the dubious approach. Appeal to conspiracy. Question the motives of scientists. It is easy to portray someone's motives as sinister. There's always some way to weave a tale about how scientists are biased or corrupt. Such claims can be manufactured out of whole cloth as needed. While bias and corruption certainly exist, that doesn't mean it is reasonable to assume that any science with which you disagree can be casually dismissed as entirely the result of such corruption. But that's exactly what deniers do. Deniers of global warming would, for instance, have you believe that climate scientists throughout the world decided to manufacture an elaborate hoax in order to increase their funding. To support their allegations, they engineered ClimateGate by trolling through thousands of hacked emails until they found some statements that could be taken out of context. Anti-GMO, genetically modified organism, activists have employed the same strategy. Just read the comments to any article on GMO and see how long it takes for anyone defending the science of GMO to be labeled a Monsanto shill. U.S. Right to Know, an anti-GMO group funded by the Organic Lobby, has used Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, requests to demand the emails of public scientists. They then scour these emails, looking for anything that could be made to seem sinister. Any connection to industry, no matter how innocent or appropriate, is spun into a narrative of nefarious corporate shilling. And of course, evolutionary biologists just hate God. At the reasonable end of the spectrum is the sensible requirement for full disclosure of potential conflicts of interest, so readers can judge for themselves the integrity of the source. This can easily slide into a witch hunt, however, with even the thinnest and most tenuous connection used to argue that a scientist is actually a paid insider and should be completely discounted. Appeal to academic intellectual freedom. Personal freedom is highly valued in U.S. culture and elsewhere, so the appeal to personal freedom is especially effective, which explains its popularity as an argument. Laws meant to shield charlatans from being held responsible for the proper standard of care in medicine are sold as healthcare freedom laws. Creationist attempts to undermine the teaching of evolution are framed as academic freedom. Anti-vaccinationists, of course, are constantly advocating for the parents' right to choose. What all such movements miss, however, is that science, academia, and professions have standards. Maintaining standards isn't anti-freedom, but it is easy to misrepresent it as such and to portray all attempts at promoting high standards as elitism. Universities, for example, are under no obligation to allow any crank to teach nonsense in their name. They do, however, have a responsibility to their students to teach only academically valid material. Argument from consequences. Accepting a particular science may be inconvenient for a specific political or religious ideology, and pointing out this inconvenience in order to deny the science is also extremely common. Creationists argue that accepting evolution will undermine belief in God and even result in moral decay. Global warming deniers argue that accepting the alarmist claims about climate change will result in a government takeover of private industry. I characterize this strategy as an argument from final consequences logical fallacy. Evolution is wrong because if it were true, society would suffer. This feature also often provides a clue as to the true motivation of the denial. The science is secondary. It's the moral hazard they're truly concerned about. This is an inherently flawed strategy. If you truly wish to advocate for a particular moral or ethical position, the worst thing you can do is tie that position to a false scientific conclusion. Doing so allows opponents to attack your moral position by attacking the pseudoscience to which you have anchored it. You are far better off acknowledging legitimate science and advocating for your moral position on moral grounds. If you ideologically favor free markets, don't deny global warming. Rather, offer free market solutions. Some researchers have labeled this phenomenon solution aversion in the case of global warming. Reject the science because you don't like the proposed solutions. Again, it's a better strategy to focus on the solutions rather than deny the science. It should be clear by now that I and my SGU colleagues are all strong advocates of science. It is clear from history that science is the most powerful tool we have for understanding the world and improving our position in it. But science requires courage. The courage to face reality and accept its findings, even if they upset us or are disruptive to our comfortable ideology. Denialism seeks to deprive us of the power of science by attacking those findings the deniers lack the intellectual courage to evaluate honestly. But denialism does not refer to specific people as much as it does to a behavior, one we need to be vigilant against in ourselves most of all. Chapter 24, Skeptic's Guide Entry, P-Hacking and Other Research Foibles. There are multiple ways to bias the outcome of seemingly rigorous scientific studies. It is critical to be able to assess the reliability of research to know if its claims should be taken seriously. The nature of science is not that of a steady, linear progression toward the truth, but rather a tortuous road often characterized by dead ends and U-turns, and yet ultimately inching toward a better, if tentative, understanding of the natural world. Massimo Piliucci. I was watching my daughter Julia play Rock'em Sock'em Robots with my 4-year-old nephew, my co-author Jay's son, Dylan. On one round, Dylan's robot knocked Julia's bot's head off, and he declared that he had won. On the next round, Julia struck first, and Dylan's robot dutifully popped his head. Again, Dylan declared that he had won. In response to Julia's questioning, he explained that on that round, the robot that lost its head was the winner. We all remember this from our first ventures into group play. Young children will sometimes try to change the rules after they see the results. We laugh now because their feeble attempts at rigging the game are so transparent and contrived. Even as older children, let alone adults, we understand that you must establish the rules ahead of time and stick with them. You don't get to decide after you see the outcome that whatever happened meant you win. Adults, however, still do this. Even respected scientists may succumb to the temptation to tweak the rules after the outcomes are known. They just do it in a much more subtle and complex way. They may not even be aware they are doing it. The rules of science are far more important than any game. They are designed specifically to control for any cheating, whether deliberate or inadvertent. Rigorously adhering to these rules has transformed our understanding of the universe and is largely how we separate what is actually true from wishful thinking. However, much of what passes for scientific research is flawed or preliminary. Some of it is utter crap. There's so much research out there, with literally millions of new studies being published each year, that you could cite scientific studies to support just about any claim you wish, if you were willing to do a little cherry-picking. How do we tell the difference between reliable, solid scientific research and low-quality research? Let's do an SGU deep dive. Here's an example of a scientific study gone wrong that we discussed on the show in early 2017. Field Effects of Consciousness and Reduction in U.S. Urban Murder Rates, Evaluation of a Prospective Quasi-Experiment. This study comes from the Maharishi University of Management. The idea here is that consciousness is a field, and there is a universal field of consciousness of which we are all a part. When individuals engage in transcendental meditation, TM, they are not only affecting their own consciousness, they're affecting the entire field. The point of this and other TM studies is to confirm the belief, They're not testing the belief that if enough people put good vibrations into the universal field of consciousness, society in general will benefit. How many is enough? Well, apparently they have an answer for that. It's the square root of 1% of the population.